Welcome to North Coast Church. Today, Pastor Chris Brown is bringing the teaching to you, so open up your Bibles and listen in.
So by now, you have already opened up your bulletin, you pulled out your study outline, and you said, what? No fill in the blanks. Chris must be teaching. And let me tell you something about how this works and why you don't have any fill in the blanks on your outline today, although I really hope you take some notes. Our outline is due every Thursday at 3 o'clock. So whoever's teaching, myself or my substitute, we have to, by 3 o'clock, have our outline in. This last Thursday, I had an opportunity early in the morning to get up and go down and spend the entire day in Mexico and see what you guys are doing. And that was amazing. Which meant somewhere on Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday, I had to get an outline done and usually my hours of sermon prep in. Although, in the midst of all my regular scheduled meetings, our executive pastor, Charlie Bradshaw, got in touch with me and said, hey, any extra time, we need to meet with department heads for next year's budget and just make sure we got that all laid down. And so there went my time. And so you have an outline with no fill in the blanks, which means we can do anything we want. Which means I want to take the first few minutes and just thank you for what you're doing. When I was taken across the border, I was immediately taken to City Hall. And I didn't know I was going there. And the City Hall infrastructure in Tijuana is absolutely amazing. And I was asking our guy that works down there, I said, hey, Eric, what are we going to City Hall for? He goes, oh, they heard you were coming. And the city councilman wants to meet with you, the guy in charge of human rights for Baja. He wants to thank you for what North Coast is doing. And I was all, are you serious? And we go to City Hall, which has got lines of people and everyone trying to meet with someone to help out their situation. And we're ushered just in front of all the lines. There's a couple different doors we go to. Finally, we get into an inner office that opens up. I sit in this incredible office, meet one of the councilmen, Rodolfo, who just says, hey, I want to thank you and your church for what you're doing down here in Tijuana. And it was one of those times, I don't even know if you know what you're doing. Years and years ago, there was a couple that was just here at North Coast every week. They had raised their kids at North Coast, their kids got married, and then they looked at each other after one service and said, why are we still going to church? It's time to stop sitting here and to do something. They had a lucrative business, they sold that, they sold their home, a beautiful home in Carlsbad, they moved to South Africa, they started working with kids after school, teaching them about Christ, and they realized you can't teach hungry kids about Christ because they don't sit still long enough and their stomachs make noise. So they put a big pot on the stove and they started feeding kids. Well, the moment you start feeding kids in South Africa, you've got a line outside of wherever you're meeting. That's where the edge, and people said, hey, let's feed them on a regular basis. From one pot to two pots, from one stove to three stoves, and then they said, let's open something different. And you guys got together and said, let's open a soup kitchen. Right now, it's doing 6,000 meals a day in South Africa. We turned that completely over to the South Africans. They're owning it, operating it, running it. It's going to help ministries all across the area of South Africa as far as we can drive with 5-gallon buckets of stew to give to ministries to keep doing what they're doing and reach more people. And you guys said, let's do it again. So we picked up a spot in Haiti. Right now in Haiti, you're doing 2,500 meals a day in the northern section of that island, just going to help orphanages and ministries that are amazing. I mean, we talked to guys in Haiti that said, all I can feed is 75 kids. And we said, what if we give you 300 meals a day? He's all, well, then I'll do 300 kids. And their little ministry sites all over Haiti have just multiplied like crazy. And so since we left that in the hand of the Haitians and the Haitians ministry, we said, where next? In Tijuana. And like you, maybe like me, I said, Tijuana, it's not even a third world country. Are there starving kids just 60 miles from my house? And I had an amazing opportunity on Thursday to go down there and drive along the government land and railroad tracks, which is open land for squatters. And see side by side by side by side by side the little 6-foot by 9-foot homes, mostly single moms with a lot of kids, whose husbands have gone off to find work or tried to cross the border and who have never come back. And homes that are built out of leftover siding, leftover billboards, homes that are put together with anything that gives you some sort of a firm structure. And I walked into the basement of a church in this little community and saw 300 kids waiting in line with little blue tickets. And they give them all at the door a blue ticket, so you can't get in line twice. And I went and talked to the three women who are feverishly working in a kitchen, who said, this is all we can do. We're maxed out at 300 kids a day. It costs us about $1 to give them their rice, their beans, their bread, with a little bit of like a salsa type on top of it. And to see row after row after row of kids, as many could squeeze on these little benches, just eating off their little styrofoam plates. It's one of the places where the women looked at me and said, when is your kitchen going to open? To save us resources and the double amount of kids this church can reach. And I had an opportunity to walk through our kitchen down there. It will open next month. You guys have done an amazing job. And we have church after church after church after church that has just lined up saying, when can we get food to our people? And when can we reach our community by offering food? And we're able to do it at about 6 cents a meal because of the vast quantity that we can do it in. It was one of those days where I just left so proud of those of you that are with Outside the Bowl is what we call it, because it's not about feeding kids. It's about what's happening outside the bowl. It's about the ministry opportunities that we're doing. We're not feeding any kid out of our soup kitchen. We're giving them all the local ministries that are doing great stuff with the gospel and allowing them just to do more. I'm so proud of you guys. I was so proud of a city council that recognized what this church is doing and just said, can you go back and tell them thanks? You are helping us change the crisis on this side of the border. While I was down there, I talked with John Alvarado. John's been a good friend of mine, a guy I dearly trust for years and years and years. And John said, hey, what if we start feeding kids on a Saturday morning in the red light district of Tijuana? See, John found out that Saturday mornings are the most vulnerable time for kids. Most of them are allowed to go to some sort of schooling during the week. But on Saturday mornings in the red light district, all these kids belong to moms and dads that are involved in the sex industry, crime, or drug industry. And on Saturday mornings, the parents haven't come home yet, or the parents are sleeping off whatever they've done that night. And the kids are just open on the streets. So John started going to Costco, buying Danishes, oatmeal, cereal, milk, coming down, setting up tables. If you eat breakfast and sit at a Bible study, we're going to do this every week. And John now has between 300 and 400 kids in the El Norte district of Tijuana every Saturday morning who line up down the city block, waiting to hear Bible stories and waiting to get a breakfast. It was 3 years ago John talked to me about this Christmas time of year and said, I want to give the kids a gift. And by the time he bought enough food for the 400 kids that were showing up on Saturday, he had about 15 to 20 cents a kid. He said, there's not much you can do with 15 to 20 cents a kid. So it broke his heart, but he bought cases of candy canes and cases of colored pencils. And he took a candy cane and a colored pencil and he put them together with a little zip tie, a little garbage bag tie. And at the end of the line, he was going to give every kid a candy cane and a pencil and just say, Merry Christmas. And it broke his heart until the kids got to the end of the line. And the kids started getting candy canes and pencils. And the first ones in line said, is this for us? And he goes, yeah, it's for you. And then they said, is there one for everyone? He goes, yeah, we have one for everyone. And they held him up and turned around and shouted to the rest of the line. And the entire line broke out with a cheer. This is the year they get Christmas presents, a candy cane, and a pencil. Well, I heard that story. I saw the video of what John was doing, and I said, John, from now on, you will have presents at the end of that line. And for the last couple of years, North Coast has come through with 400 gifts. And when these kids get to the end of the line, and they get soccer balls, and they get Legos, and they get dolls, oh, you should see the excitement on the faces. For 2 years in a row now, they've had real Christmas presents. It's just one a person, but man, they've had presents. And the city council meant his thanks. No one here cares about the kids who are born of prostitutes. Many of them look American because it's the Americans that have come down and visited their moms. You don't understand how they don't fit our culture. Thank your church for loving our unlovable. John said, Chris, a lot of times these kids don't show up and we have to go to their homes. He said, that's when I realized the situation. And if you go down there, it looks like little closets in like our storage units that you can rent, a long hallway with just a bunch of doors. But the doors have been kicked in and broken in so many times, there's no handles on them, there's just holes. And so what they do is there's holes in the wall and they put chains through their door with a padlock. And inside, it's a 6-foot by 8-foot square, no electricity, no water. And he said, when the moms go out to work the streets, when the moms go out in the crime or drug or sex trade, they lock their kids in these squares so the kids will at least be safe and they know where they are. But if the moms don't come back for that night or for days, the kids just stay there until someone can come and unlock. And he said, so we took the candy canes and pencils. And when the kids heard that we came to them, you saw these little hands come out the little hole where the knobs used to be. And John would get down and say, how many are in there? And he said, we have 5 brothers and sisters. And John would pass through 5 candy canes and 5 pencils. Whatever Danishes he would fold up and fit through there. And John said, I know it's late and it's too late for your church. You already have the giving tree set up. But this year I would love to give a blanket to every kid. These kids don't have blankets. They're not allowed to sleep on the one bed. And I said, John, I promise you, I will get you 400 blankets this Christmas. People, I promise you, I don't think I can buy 400 blankets. Whatever you don't come up with, I'm coming up with. And yet I told them, a church our size will get you 500 blankets. So on this campus, there's giving trees out in the plaza, at the entrance. I know in Carlsbad and Fallbrook, you have some of your own Christmas stuff going on. And yet any campus that brings a blanket for a child, pick up the extra $9, the little Cars blanket, the Buzz Lightyear blanket, a Tinkerbell blanket, whatever you're, just bring it in here. And if we get blankets, we are taking them down. And at the end of that breakfast line for Christmas breakfast this year, those kids are going to get a meal, they're going to get a gift, and they are each going to get a blanket to take home that they can sleep on from North Coast. And it's that generosity that when they find out the pastor from the church is coming, they said, let's open City Hall. We just want to say thanks because no one's caring about the kids, the innocent victims that are trapped on this side of the border. Guys, I just tell you, I am proud to be part of what you are doing. This Christmas season, I encourage you. I know we come to a time and place where we want more, where we'd love to do more for our family, where our kids have crazy gift ideas. We've gone away with making a Christmas list at my house. It's just stupid. Like, I want a car. What kind of car? A real car. I'm all, shut up. You're 8. But if I get one now, I can keep it in the garage, and you can teach me how to drive until I get... This is stupid. Everything they want. Flat screens and iPod Nanos. I mean, I'm like, we're not... Forget it. You're going to be happy with the doll, and that's it. No more list. There's always more of what we want and what we want to do. Amy and I decided early going into this season, we want to give to other kids more than we give to our own. We'll still have Christmas. We'll always have an amazing Christmas. But we just wanted to start something, and we told our kids, we're going to give to other kids as much or more than what we give to you guys. And that's something we want to start and start doing. I encourage you. Dave Inns talked about the Yormans here in Live, the missionaries that you guys are supporting. Every venue has missionaries or missions that they are supporting. Everyone this time of year is strapped. And those that have left North Coast and left their homes to go overseas to do work in ministry are hurting just like we are. Find a vehicle somewhere in whatever venue you're at, whatever ministry or Mexico, find a vehicle somewhere to say, all right, I'm going to do something other than our family. It could be $5. It could be $10. I tell you, $5 and $10 goes a long way in a lot of these countries. When we can do meals for 8 cents a meal, $5 gets a lot of meal. I'm not about to do the math in front of you, but find something somewhere in some venue, a missionary or mission. And I just encourage us as North Coast. You guys have always done well, 3,000 and 4,000 presents for our local charities and communities. Continue to encourage you. Find some place to step out and say, what about them? What about them? Congratulations. In Tijuana, City Council just wanted to say thanks. We can't wait until your kitchen opens and see what it does in the life of our churches. To have a councilman with tears in his eyes say, we have been praying for God's love in a significant way to change what's happening in our communities. And we think you guys are a huge part of that. I just want to say thanks. Fun stuff. So I didn't do fill in the blanks. Isn't that good? Okay, start teaching. I know you're like, start teach? I thought you were going to close in prayer. Not a chance. Let's shift gears. Let's pray. Father, thanks. God, so many times we get caught up in what we do not have that we forget what we have. We get so caught up in our wants and where we want to be in life that we forget where we are in life. And we forget that even those of us that would consider ourselves the poorest in all of our venues here are still the richest in the world. God, may this be a year where we find something, some amount, and some place to give outside of ourselves, simply to say thanks and to let others know, hey, there's Christians that care. There's a God that loves you. This is from Him, not us. God, may you continue to find us faithful in all that we have and how we use it. As we jump into your word, God, I pray that you make it clear that, God, we all walk out knowing we have heard from you. In Jesus' name, amen. We are in the book of Luke, chapter 22. I think according to how my calculations, this is the sixth week we are spending on one night. Man, that's got to be some night. That night that Jesus went to the upper room with his boys, that night of the famous Last Supper, that night where he said, someone here is going to betray me. That night where he left there and walked to the garden, that's where we left him last week. I think it's just part of the strategy of Jesus. He knows he's going to be betrayed. And if Judas brings the guard to an upper room in the midst of a city that is packed with travelers for the Passover celebration, there is going to be a riot. And there will be a massacre and bloodshed. I believe that is the reason he goes to the garden. I believe that is the reason he goes out to a quiet place. He knows this cross is about him, no one else. He stops and he asks his disciples to pray with him. And last week we looked at the simplicity, the openness, the honesty of prayer. And no one ever told me as a little kid growing up in church, Jesus did not want to die for you, Chris. In fact, those words sound strange to hear in church. As a little kid in the flannel graph board in Jesus, I thought Jesus just kind of skipped to the cross and jumped up on it. Like, ah, and it's like, oh, he loves me so much. And no one ever told me, oh, no. He begged three times not to die for you, Chris. The act of love is that God the Father said, thanks for your honesty. Son, you have to die. The act of love was dying for me when three times he cried out he didn't want to. But when God said this is the only way salvation comes to Chris and all. It's the thing about Christianity that drives others crazy and those of us inside to frustration. Is it really the only religion? Is it any the only way? Oh, if there is any other religion, any other philosophy, any other way to be saved, then I want out of Christianity as soon as possible. I do not want to follow a sadistic God who tortures his son for no absolute reason, just to be one of many ways. And trust me, I don't want to follow a dumb Jesus. A Jesus that's duped into dying on the cross when it's not the only way to heaven, that's a stupid Jesus. Unless he's the Son of God. And this is the way for salvation. And it's that garden scene where three times Jesus begged, is there any other way for our friends, our families, our neighborhoods to be saved? And God said, this is it. It's what separates Christianity from all other beliefs, all other religions. And when he wrestles with the prayer, the answer comes immediately. This is not an arrest. This is a murder. This is not going to be done publicly. This will not be done in the open courts. This will not be done with justice. This will be done quickly, quietly, in the darkness, away from the crowds. Your Bibles may have little headings, the arrest of Jesus. You might want to circle a line or cross through the word arrest and just put murder. There's no trial going on here. And in verse 47, while he, being Jesus, was still speaking, a crowd came up, and the man who was called Judas, one of the 12, was leading them. He approached Jesus to kiss him, but Jesus asked him, Judas, are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss? Oh, what a moment. And you always wonder, why the kiss? Well, it's dark. They don't have park lights in the garden. It's a crowded time. People, there's probably others around the garden or camping out close by. When Judas is going to bring the chief priests, the guards of the temple, the guards of Rome, they got to know in the darkness, who is it we're going after? You can get close and point, but Judas says, hey, there's a sign of affection that we do to our rabbi. I'll kiss him on the cheek. I'm sure it wasn't the first time. That's how you'll know. And in the darkness with the guards armed behind him, as he approaches and kisses Jesus, Jesus, I love it. Really? You're betraying me with a kiss. Pretending to be affectionate to your Lord and Savior, or at the same time, going against my will and my desire. Nice job, Judas. And before we jump on, I just want to put some stuff down on how Judas fooled them all. You're used to looking up for the PowerPoint and fill in the blanks. I'll probably say it again because I'm going to catch you looking up. We don't have any this week. I was in Mexico. But whatever you want to write down, write down. I'll give you stuff at the end I want you to write down. You see how I put 4 points? I didn't have those either when I turned it in. I was just sure we could come up with four something. So we've talked about Judas before, but once again, how Judas fooled them all. Because there is the heart of your pastor that just says, man, my hope and my prayer and my fear is that one day we stand before Christ, one day when our heart stops beating, we take the last breath, and there are people that have sat in our venues week in and week out who have found out what you already know inside. Now, we have a lot of Judases. You see, you can put it this way. Being close to Jesus does not mean you're close to Jesus. Oh, for 3 years, he was one of the closest to Jesus. Always got to ride in the boat. Always got to walk with him. Always got to sleep at night around the fire with Jesus. For 3 years, he was the closest to Jesus. And yet we find out looking back, he was never close to Jesus. You can be around the things of God without ever truly being a person of God. Just because you have position does not ensure your faithfulness. Oh, he was one of the 12. He had titles. It started with disciple. Then he's called apostle. Just because you're gifted does not ensure you have faithfulness. Just because you're serving, maybe even full time, does not ensure your faithfulness. A display of affection does not ensure your faithfulness. It's ironic that he seals this with a kiss. We can get emotional in worship. We can get weepy over stories. We can come to church and get filled with little warm fuzzies. That has nothing to do with truly being a follower of Christ. I felt that at a U2 concert. It just happens. I was going to say at Charger games, but I haven't felt that in a long time. So, at good sporting teams that I watch, you feel those things. Becoming a Tebow fan, I'm going to admit that. I don't know why either. I'm like, what? That's a unicorn. How's that win? Oh my gosh, ADD just runs rampant. Think of the life of Judas. He's under great teaching. He's in an amazing growth group. He's got a mentor who walks on water. He is in full-time ministry. He's got a Christian resume like none of us can compete with. Well, who discipled you? Jesus Christ? Oh. Well, what were your studies? Well, I got a degree in miracles. Saw every one of them. Well, that's pretty good. Actually did them himself. You ever been exposed to any decent teaching? I sat there with the Sermon on the Mount. And every day. You ever been in ministry? Yeah, full time, 3 years. Where'd you work? I was the treasurer for Jesus Christ Ministries. Oh, the Jesus Christ Ministries? Yeah. Oh, he can out-resume any of us in Christianity. And yet we find along the way, and John looking back will give us hints. We looked at it several weeks ago. He's got two problems. One, a problem with money. He's always saying, what's in it for me? And along the way, he was always taking. You see, Judas is a taker, not a giver. Judas is someone that would come and sit in the venues. Judas is someone that would come to church on a regular basis. Always, though, with what's in it for me. When do I get mine? He was never a giver. He was never one to surrender. He was always one that just held onto his money bag saying, when is this going to grow? When does the magic genie pay off for me? We also know that he did not like the direction Jesus was going. He's all about a conquering Messiah. He's all about a Messiah that's going to break through and make life better. But a suffering Messiah? See, it was later on the trip where Jesus started talking about dying. I think that's where the split started to happen. Judas was all about following a Jesus that was about to bring a kingdom. Not if it meant suffering. See, you only know your degree of dependence, faithfulness, your Christianity, if you will. It's only determined when obedience is going to cost you. Not when obedience is something you want to do. It's those areas of life where obedience will cost you. It's that area of life, and I hear it so often, where it means you have to change your living condition and who you're living with, your sexuality, where it means you have to change some of your finances, where it means you have to change how you love your enemies, where it means a direction shift from your goals. That's where you're going to find your obedience. I have never told my kids that they have to finish their ice cream. Never. Oh, they finished their ice cream. In fact, I look and go, hey, way to lick the bowl. I didn't know you could get to the bottom of that with your tongue. And I'm like, you got a little ring around your eyebrows. And they take, and I'm like, whoa. I've never told my kids, now you're not going to leave the table until you finish your dessert. My problem's always been the broccoli. Buddy, there's still 3 trees on your plate. And I'm like, here it comes. Obedience is not found in the things you want to do. Obedience is found in the things you don't want to do. It's that area of our life that we hold back and say, oh, I don't like God's direction on this. Or here's why it's different for us. Or here's why I think the original text doesn't actually have these words in it. As if God couldn't protect his own word over generations. And we find a Judas who has the right resume, everything that's going in life. And yet we find a guy that's able to betray for 30 pieces of silver. Man, my hope, my prayer is that our venues are not filled with people that are around the things of God without being the men and women of God who somehow have slipped into a Judas thinking that because we surround ourselves with teaching and growth groups, because I've got a position or I volunteer, because I'm giving something, that it means I'm close to God. Closeness to God, faithfulness, has always been, will always be, obedience. End of story. In the areas that are going to cost us. That's the measure of your faithfulness. And that'll tell you if you're a follower of Christ or a follower of yourself with a magic genie to make things better. We say it almost every week. All we do is obedience, and yet we still get cards from people. How often are we going to speak about obedience? And I just send back the same reply, until we die. And after we die, you're going to realize, oh, obedience was pretty much all there was. And I'm like, see, we were right. Okay. How Judas fooled them all. The truth about betrayal. Read the story, verse 49. When Jesus' followers saw what was going to happen, they said, Lord, should we strike with our swords? And one of them struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his right ear. They don't wait for an answer. Should we strike? No, it's a little late for that one. It's the kid that shows up with brownies all over his face. Mom, can I have one? It's like, well, glad you asked the question. You acted a little too soon. Now, John chapter 18 will tell us which one actually cut off an ear. And of course, we would know it's Peter. But Jesus answered, no more of this. And he touched the man's ear and he healed him. How does that not stop the story right there? How does that not let the guards go, maybe the Son of God, I'm out of here. I love that the disciples can't fight. I love that they're a bunch of ex-fishermen. I love that Peter takes the sword and he swings it and all he gets is an ear. Because you know he's used to casting, not jabbing. He's like, should we fight? Yeah! And the guy's like, really? Are you kidding me? I wonder if it fell in the dirt. I guess it wouldn't flip around, but I wonder if it fell in the dirt. And Jesus just picks it up, puts it on his ear. And the guy's like, really? Right there, that guy's like, you arrest him. I'm out of here. That guy's good. I love that Peter is not rebuked. It's not called a sin. I love that Jesus doesn't chastise him. He just says, no, no more of this. It's almost as if, I think it is, that Jesus is simply saying, I'm going to take the cross on this one, guys. If I got a bunch of ex-fishermen that decide to fight skilled warriors and guards, we all go down in the garden. I think it's part of the strategy of Jesus is simply saying, I'm taking the cross. You run and take the story. I'm going to take the cross. Your role is to take the story. And I'm going to put the ear back on. Because Peter, if this guy takes a swing at you, he's going to get more than an ear. And the disciples run. And in the midst of what's going to come over the next days of the beating, the crucifixion, I think one of the hardest wounds is the fact that simply the betrayal came from within. It was one of my boys. It was one of the 12. It was the one I gave a privileged position to. Have you ever noticed the truth about betrayal? It's those that are closest to us that are going to hurt us the deeply. It's those that we trust the most that have the tendency to hurt us the most. It is those that one day stood in front of you and said, till death do us part, only to find out they didn't really mean it. What they meant was, I'm really going to do my best until things get hard. And then it's going to be about me. Oh, and the wound that carries. It's those that God has given the position to protect us, to train us, to equip us. That position of mom and dad that bring us into the world and give us the structure for growing us to be the men and women we're supposed to be. And yet from those very hands, the hurt and the betrayal. And decades later, we still walk with a wound. Because that position should never wound a child. It's those closest friends or business partners that we have trusted. It's those closest to us that can hurt us the deeply. I said it again. I don't know how to say it differently. English teachers just cringe every time I speak. I know it. That's the truth about betrayal. And for Jesus, it comes from one of his own. It doesn't come from the enemies outside. It comes from within. And in verse 52, then Jesus said to the chief priests, the officers of the temple guard and the elders who had come for him. Am I leading a rebellion that you have come with swords and clubs? Every day I was with you in the temple courts, and you did not lay a hand on me. But this is your hour, when darkness reigns. Oh, I love that phrase so much. I'm like, well, at least I know the title, When Darkness Reigns. Man, what do you do in those moments? Jesus will not defend himself. He will defend others. But the truth about betrayal, when you're betrayed by friends, I love where Jesus goes on this. Really? You come at me with armed guards? Every day I was teaching publicly. Every day you knew who I was and what I was about. And this is done under darkness. This isn't an arrest. This is murder. And it's his strategy and it's his obedience and his love for you and I that says, I'll take the cross, you take the story, and he walks. Before we look at how to handle those that are closest to us that betray us, Jesus betrayed by friends, I want you to take a look at one who is betrayed by family. Leave something here in Luke 22, but go to the very first book of the Bible, Genesis chapter 41. Genesis chapter 41. I think we'll start at verse 46. If you're dealing with betrayal, this is a story you got to read. It takes 12 chapters, so we're not going to read it all this morning, but we need to cover 12 chapters. I want you to go back and look at this story about betrayal. It's a story of a guy named Joseph. From an early age, God put some giftedness in his life. God has given him some dreams. But from an early age, well, he was kind of a punk kid, an early teenager who didn't know how to handle some giftedness. See, he was born with 12 brothers, and he was the youngest, and he was Poppy's favorite. And Dad loved him so much, he didn't send him out in the fields to work to get all dirty and grubby. In fact, he didn't get dirty at all. He was given a coat of many colors. So when the older brothers came back from doing all the family business and watching all the sheep and, you know, all the barbed wire fence and taking care of all the cattle, and they come home, and there's the little brother who never gets dirty, and he's got a coat of many colors, yeah, it sits a little wrong with you. Now, as years go on and he's old enough to go outside by himself, Dad sends him to the field to report on his brothers. So now you got a favorite snitch in the family. Oh, it gets even worse. Little Joey starts having dreams. Now, he doesn't know how to keep these dreams himself. He has very little EQ, or I would say he has no EQ, because he can't read his brothers and the anger on their face. In fact, he'll go out to the fields and just tell them, hey, guys, I had a dream that one day all of you are going to bow down to me. And they're like, we hate your guts. Well, he'd come out from time and time again, and he'd keep having dreams. And they'd be sitting around the dinner table. And I, hey guys, guess what? I had another dream that all of you are going to be my slaves one day. Yeah, it gets old after a while. Well, one day little Joey goes out in the field. He's 17 years old at this time and he hasn't learned his letters. And his brother's like, let's just kill the punk right now. But you got a problem. If you kill your brother, Dad's probably going to realize he's missing and get upset. So how do you cover up? So they throw him in a deep pit, and they're trying to figure out, how can we get away with this? Just then a bunch of camels and horses come by on their way to Egypt, and they're like, hey, you guys got any slaves to sell? We need some slaves. And they're like, why, yes, we do. And they take little Joey out of the hole, and they sell him for some Slurpee money, and Joey goes down to Egypt. Now, he gets down to Egypt, and he gets sold as a slave. He's bought by a guy named Potiphar. Potiphar's got a pretty wealthy estate. In fact, he's high up in the social elitism of Egypt. Well, Potiphar's gone on a lot of business trips because that's what he does. And Potiphar has a wife who takes one look at Joey and realizes, boy, he's a tan, smooth-skinned fellow. He hasn't been outside in the sun working. He's soft. He's a good-looking guy. Hey, my husband's away on business. Can you come up? There's some stuff in my bedroom that needs some work on. And Joey's like, no, I'm not going to do that. And time again, she keeps asking him. Finally, one day, he's in the house doing work. Everybody's outside, and she decides just to jump on him. He takes off screaming and yelling. She's embarrassed, so she calls rape. Well, now, if you're a slave in Egypt and a very wealthy woman's wife reclaims rape, you're not going to get a trial. You're just sentenced to life in prison. This is where Joey's going. He gets in prison. This should be the time where he really gives up on life and gives up on God. Not Joey. He starts a prison ministry from the inside out. And he figures, I'm here. Let's find out how the other inmates are doing. And his little section of the dungeon is so well taken care of that they just put him in charge of it. I know none of us want to be number one inmate, but he's the best that he could do. So that's the position that he rises to. Well, someone else comes in, and he's having some weird dreams, too. And Joey says, man, I'm good with dreams. What's your dream? And this guy says, I used to work for Pharaoh. Here's what's going on. Here's my dream. And Joseph says, oh, your dream means you're going to be released, and you're going to get your position back. And when you do, remember me. Sure enough, the guy gets released, his position back, but he doesn't remember Joe. He's just glad to be on the outside world again. Well, 2 years go by, and Pharaoh starts having dreams. The most powerful man in the known world at that time. Pharaoh's got some really funky dreams. He's just in his nighttime, just dreaming about these big, chubby cows that are eating big, luscious grass by the Nile River. And then little skinny cows come out of the river, skinny, gaunt, like sunken face, like weird looking cows, and their mouths open real big and start eating all the other cows. And he wakes up all sweating. He's like, and he keeps having skinny cows with big mouth dreams. And so he gathers all of his wise men around and says, can someone tell me what the dream is? And they're all, no. Well, the guy that's in his palace goes, hey, I just remembered a dude in prison that can do pretty well with dreams. So they clean up Joey. They come to him, and Joseph goes, hey, here's the deal. It means that you're going to have 7 years of great wealth and great crops and great harvest, but then there's going to be 7 years of famine. And Pharaoh goes, are you serious? He goes, yeah, that's what your dream is. What should I do? And Joseph says, here's what you should do. For 7 years, take a whole bunch of the crops, store them all up to get you through the other 7 years. It'll make you even more wealthy because you're the only one with food. And Pharaoh says, you're the smartest guy I know. Can you be second in command? And Joseph's like, nah, I'm number one inmate, second in command. Yeah, I'll take the job. And so now he's second in command of Egypt. Well, he does. For 7 years, he does great with the grain. His brothers come up to visit. And Joseph's like, no way. He's seeing the line of people that need food. And he realizes, my brothers. It's been 13 years since they sold him as a slave. He's 30 years old now, clean shaven, got the little Egyptian headband on. His brothers have no clue who he is. They're probably bowed down looking at the tile floor anyway. And Joseph's like, this was the dream. But he doesn't tell his brothers who he is because not all the brothers there. The little one's gone. So he plays a little game with them back and forth just to make sure his dad's still alive, his little brother, or did you guys kill little brother as well? He wanted to find out their character change. It's a long story, but his brothers come back and he goes, guys, everyone clear the palace. And everyone leaves the palace. And Joseph takes off his headband and goes, it's me, Joe. And they're like, Joe who? And they're like, Joe, the guy you sold for Slurpees. And they're like, are you going to kill us? And he's like, no, go get dad. Bring him down here. The whole family will be safe. And Joseph sets him up with the best of land and the best of food throughout the famine. And Genesis chapter 41, maybe you didn't have to read 12 chapters. Genesis 41, verse 46. 41, 46. Joseph was 30 years old when he entered the service of Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. And Joseph went out from Pharaoh's presence, traveled throughout Egypt. And during the 7 years of abundance, the land produced plentifully. Joseph collected all the food produced in those 7 years of abundance in Egypt and stored it in the cities. In each city, he put the food grown in the fields surrounding it. Joseph stored up huge quantities of grain like the sand of the sea. It was so much that he stopped keeping records because it was beyond measure. Now, before the years of famine came, two sons were born to Joseph by Asenath, daughter of Potipharah, the priest of On. Joseph named his firstborn Manasseh and said, it is because God has made me forget all my troubles and all of my father's household. The second son he named Ephraim and said, it is because God has made me fruitful in the land of my suffering. Stop. Before the brothers even come back, before he understands what the early dreams were about, he's gotten to a place where there are two things. Well, there are two things that are core to Joseph. So core to him that when he has sons, I will name them both who I am and what I've become. He does not give them Egyptian names. He gives them Hebrew names. And the first one he says, my firstborn will be called Manasseh because God has allowed me to forget what my family has done to me. Now, he didn't forget what happened. He didn't blank out. That Manasseh word means to be able to let go and forgive. It's behind me. Oh, I had times as a slave. I had times in my dungeon where I had hatred. But man, I've been able to get through that. It is so core to Joseph that when his son is born, you're going to be called forgiveness. That's what God's allowed me to do with the betrayal in my life. And when the second son is born, he says, your name will be fruitfulness. Because I've been able to forgive and get over the family betrayal and them selling me as a slave and telling my father I was dead. Because I've been able to get over that. Oh, I've been fruitful and catch it in the land of my slavery. God never took me out of my position. God never answered the prayer that I would one day find a way back home. God never got me out of Egypt. But in my Egypt, oh, he has made me fruitful. The two things that are the very core of Joseph, he puts on the heads of his son, forgiveness and fruitfulness. Oh, that's the story of my life, he says. Well, his brothers come, get in line. They find out it's Joseph. They go back, get their dad. They move down. They are set up with the best of land in Egypt, and they have food all through the famine until their dad dies. And the brothers wonder. now that Dad's dead, is Joseph going to repay us for selling them out? And the end of the story is chapter 50, still in Genesis. Chapter 50, verse 15. May I just add, thanks for bringing Bibles. Oh, I spoke at a church last week in Arizona, a large church, and I said, turn to, and everyone looked at me and they're like, turn what? Because I was a visiting pastor, I could say things I wouldn't normally say. Thanks for bringing Bibles. If you don't have one, we'll always provide one for you. They're $5 in the bookstore. If you don't have $5, it's yours for free. It's the Word of God that matters here, not someone's communication ability or what they have to say. Bring it, write it, take notes, so you can go home, and when betrayal hits, you got something to look at. Don't call me and ask for PowerPoints from 2007. Glad you're bringing Bibles. Genesis chapter 50, verse 15. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, what if Joseph holds a grudge against us and pays us back for all the wrong that we did to him? So they sent word to Joseph saying, your father left these instructions before he died. Oh, they're just trying to cover their butts. But still, they're like, Dad's dead. What if Joseph goes... Let's tell Joseph that Dad's last words were, be nice to your brothers. This is what you are to say to Joseph. I ask you to forgive your brothers I ask you to forgive your brothers the sins and the wrongs they committed in treating you so badly. Now please forgive the sins of the servants of the God of your father. And when their message came to him, Joseph wept. And Joseph realized, Dad didn't say these words. You guys still think I'm going to kill you for what you did to me. You still don't get it. I have two sons, forgiveness and fruitfulness. That runs deep, brothers. So Joseph said to them, don't be afraid. Oh, verse 18. His brothers then came, threw themselves down before him. We are your slaves, they said. And Joseph said to them, don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? You intended to harm me. But God intended it for good, to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. So then don't be afraid. I will provide for you and your children. And he reassured them and spoke kindly to them. I love that line. Don't miss it. Don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? In other words, oh, you're probably going to get it someday, but it's not mine. I'm not the one that's going to judge. I'm not the one bringing consequences. That's God's. Here's all I know. Because of the way I've gone through this and I've handled it, what you meant for incredible harm, God has used for great good. And the greatest betrayal that you have gone through in your life from friends or from family, and the greatest degree of pain that you are feeling, oh, God can still bring great good out of it. And Joseph says, actually, this was for the salvation of many. I've been able to forgive. And because of that, I've been given a fruitful life. I love the parallels of these stories. Joseph was actually sold for 20 pieces of silver. Jesus outranked him slightly by 30 pieces of silver. Joseph was sold by his own family, Jesus by his spiritual family, if you will, one closest to him. Joseph says, I don't want to be a slave, and I know I don't want to live in a dungeon. But if that's where I am, I'm going to do the best that I can do. The only thing he knew is as a slave, he's like, it can't get any worse, until he gets thrown in prison. He's like, oh, I guess it can always get worse. And here I'll be obedient. Jesus did not want to go to the cross, and yet he knew what that's what he's called to do. He says, rise, let's go meet my betrayer. I'll go to the cross. Joseph says, in this hour of darkness, God has been able to save many. And Jesus goes to the cross, understanding this will be salvation of all. What if, this is going to scare some of you, what if your betrayal is the greatest ministry opportunity you'll ever have? What if your betrayal is where your light can shine the brightest? It's true of Joseph. It's definitely true of Jesus. Be careful who we're called to follow. So how do you handle betrayal? What do you do when it happens to you? I want to give you four things. These I want you to write down. Number one, just write this down. Know who you are and what you're supposed to do. Know who you are and what you're supposed to do. Oh, it jumps off of both these pages, clear as a bell. Jesus knew who he was and what he was supposed to do, and therefore he was able to walk through the hour where darkness reigns. Joseph, once he got over himself and realized, now I'm at a point where it's not about me being all high and mighty, but God, I'm yours. Then he saw in his betrayal what he was supposed to do. Never, ever forget, those of you that are followers of Christ, that you are bought at a price that makes you extremely valuable. God says, out of the entire world, then you will be my treasured possession. You are a son or a daughter of God. You are a prince or a princess in the kingdom of God. You are heir to the throne. Never forget who you are and what you're supposed to do. You are called to represent him. Pure and simple. The reason why I fight betrayal is because it's in defense of Chris. It's my life. It's my reputation. And when I remember who I am and what I'm supposed to do, I realize it's not my life, it's his. Let me ask you, in your betrayal, whose life and reputation are you fighting so hard for, yours or his? Mine happened in a ministry, and a youth ministry that was thriving out in the East LA area in a city called Pomona. We had basketball courts. We made a game room. We got an entire two-floor youth center that was given to us. And man, the kids would just come in out of the darkness. It was a safe house for every walk of life. And oh, we started seeing high schoolers by the hundreds showing up to this place. So I gathered a team of some of my closest friends and people that love students around me. One of my closest friends was on my ministry team. And in the course of reaching students and doing amazing ministry, I started hearing back, hey, we hear you're a liar. And I'm like, what? And we hear some of the stories that you're saying to these kids aren't your stories, but you're getting them from other places or you're making them up. We hear you're trying to pass them off as your own. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Oh, that your car hit a barbed wire fence in the desert and spun around four times and robbed barbed wire around it. That wasn't yours. That you jumped off a motorcycle because you had a snake on it. And I was like, what? And I started tracking down. And the source came from one of my closest friends on my ministry team. And in a confrontation, the whole thing blew up. So I immediately go home and I call my dad. I said, Dad, I've never really asked for a lot of help from you, but I need something. He's like, what do you need, son? I said, you know the story is that time where I wrapped a barbed wire fence around my car? And he's like, yep. I said, remember the time I got a rattlesnake and I wrapped it up and it was on my bike, and on the way home I jumped off my motorcycle? Yeah. And Dad's like, I know you're an idiot. And I'm like, yeah, I know. Can you simply write a paper just mentioning, and I gave him four stories, and just say, that's my idiot son, call me if you want. And he's like, Chris, what is this about? And I said, I got a guy that was a close friend of mine who's telling people now I'm lying about the stuff I'm telling students. And he's all, that's what this is about? I'm like, yeah, so I could use that documentation. And he's all, absolutely not. I said, what? And he goes, I didn't raise my son to be a man who fights like a third grader on the playground. That's the problem with having a West Texas dad. He goes, if your character is a liar, everyone knows you're a liar. If your character is not to be a liar, no one's going to believe it. Do you need anything else? No. Click. Oh, I was ticked that my dad didn't come to my defense. We walked through a process for several months that just got heated. And he said, and I was sitting in the midst of this. And I remember taking during that time my youth group to a big concert where I'm up front jumping around. We got all these kids in Pasadena at this concert and we're having a blast. And I just felt like God was saying, Chris, step away. And I walked to the back of the room and he goes, just watch him. And I just watched my youth group. And so clearly I heard God say, do you really think this is yours? Way to go, buddy. And man, it hit me. I was defending my life, my reputation, my ministry. And God saying, it's not yours if you're mine. Oh, but betrayal hurts. Well, you don't know what they're saying about me. You don't know what my ex is. You don't know what's happening. I don't. But I look at stories in the Bible and Jesus will defend others but not himself and say, no. My character was with you every day in the temple courts. That's who I am. I'm not a thief that you come at me with clubs and swords. But I'll go with you. See, secondly, pursue obedience and nothing else. Pursue obedience and nothing else. Let your character be your best defense. Joseph says, so you're going to sell me into slavery? I'm going to be the best slave I can be. Can't get worse than that. Oh, a life in a dungeon? Okay, I'll be the best inmate that I can be. Man, Joseph is a guy that says, I will let my character speak for itself in the worst of betrayal. We have a Christ that will always say throughout this, not even defending himself, simply, I am who you say I am. I'm the Son of God. My track record proves it. I was in the temple courts every day. Everyone saw it. My character will be my defense. And don't sin when others ask you to sin. Because in the midst of betrayal, there will be others that will constantly get you to sin. Oh, I hear what's going on. What in the world is he thinking? Whoa, let me tell you about this guy. No, don't sin. It's going to be so easy to caught up. And you doing your own backstabbing, you doing your own truth-telling, you doing your own storytelling. Don't sin when others ask you to sin. They're going to make it so easy for you in the midst of betrayal. And because of what that person has done, it's only right that you go after them. Don't go there. Thirdly, surrender it to God. Surrender it to God. Obedience is always your next step, and then surrender it to God. May I remind you, you are the one losing sleep over it, not them. Oh, the betrayal may have happened 10, 20, 30 years ago. It is still killing you. They're sleeping peacefully. And Joseph had to get to a point, and I don't know how many nights in the dungeon, 13 years, he was a slave and a prisoner. And I don't know how long it took before he realized, this is killing me. The betrayal's happening every night, and I'm allowing it. God, it's yours. He's not saying it's right. He's saying, God, it's yours. He's not saying there shouldn't be justice. He's just saying, God, it's yours. Because fourthly, let God be the judge and jury. Let God be the judge and jury. This is just opening into next week. Next week, we're going to dive into how to deal with injustice and betrayal even deeper. But for today, I just want to leave you with what we'll read next week. Let God be the judge and jury. I mean, think about it. The person that's betrayed you, don't they deserve punishment? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Who can give a better punishment? You or God? Yeah. Oh, the people in my life that have betrayed me, I'm like, God, you take this one. And I pray the type of judgment I think they should have. My God, I'll let you decide. Because that's biblical. Some of my favorite prayers come from David. God, my enemies, they're your enemies. Take care of them. I would just like to give you bullet points on how I'd like to see them taken care of. Your son, Dave. And I'm like, that's a good prayer. Surrender. It's that act of letting go and saying, God, it's yours. You're the judge. You're the jury. Take care of it because I'm your treasured possession. And the only thing that stands in the way of you being the man or woman of God that he wants you to be in betrayal is disobedience. And when you pursue obedience, it's the only bridge God needs to do what he wants to do in your life. In the midst and the time when darkness reigns. Next week we'll jump more into it. But for now, Father, thanks for who you are and what you've done, for the way you love us. May this be a season where we give back to others because you've given us a joy and forgiveness and a fruitfulness. And God, for those that are struggling in their betrayal now, I pray that they'd walk through this with you, that in their Egypt, you will show them the light that they are still called to live. God, may you take away the anger, the hatred, knowing that you are our judge and jury. God, may we surrender it, and may you restore the joy that we have lost because of it. And teach us our next step is always simply the right thing to do. And give us the strength to do the right thing when the wrong thing feels good and seems so easy. In Jesus' name, amen.
So before we close, if you want more information about this teaching or any other teaching, just go online, www.northcoastchurch.com. Or you can come see us at 2405 North Santa Fe Avenue in Vista, California. Check the website for times of services. And now let's get back to some closing thoughts from Pastor Chris.
You know, as you go, you always get a message like this, and there's always those of us that would rather respond like Peter. Just get me a sword. And I look at the way Jesus responds or the Bible tells, and you're like, dude, that's weakness. But think about it. Is strength taking a sword and cutting off an ear? Because that's the best you can do. Or is strength having the entire power of heaven in your pocket and choosing not to use it? Is strength taking a wild string with the sword, or a few hours later standing in front of a servant girl and not being able to admit that you're a follower? Strength and betrayal is someone that could respond like a third grader on a playground, but chooses instead to let the power of heaven be their judge and jury and take the road of obedience when the easiest thing to do is to start slinging mud and fights. It's the choice of strength that Jesus picked that night, and as followers, what we're asked to pick today. Next week, more on handling injustice and betrayals. Until then, I don't know who you're supposed to turn around and greet, so just greet somebody, and we'll see you next week.